Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this time we sail on Stranger Tides. Actually, this is a film I've been wanting to review for a while. It's been out now for a while, but, you know, it's a film I kind of enjoyed and I wanted to review. And I'm joined on my pirate adventure by Mark Christensen. How are you, sir?
I was going to launch into some pirate talk, but I'm going to spare you all. I'm doing great. Thanks.
Actually, this is the most piratey of the pirate films, so I think that you'd be quite justified. Well, I don't know. Maybe that justified. Yes. So, and things, where are you coming to us from?
Presumably? Yeah, San Francisco, the hometown.
Excellent. And from the other side of the great United States of America, Jason Diamond. How are you, sir?
Good evening. Good morning.
So Jason is coming to us via phone because he's on a secret location and can't be on the internet. We can't discuss why, but just suffice it to say, it's pretty bloody exciting. We wanted to get you on particularly, Jason, because this film was shot famously with the red cameras, and you're a bit of a red camera nut.
I am.
So I guess I'm going to start by saying, even before we do our what did you think of the film, what did you think of the look of the film, Jason?
I have to, my caveat on what I thought, how the film looked, was that I wasn't able to see it in 3D.
Okay. Well, that's good because I did.
I saw it in 2D on what must have been the oldest print and most looked at print, in the history of man.
Okay.
So it was a little desaturated. It was a little scratchy. It was a little, not, you know, it definitely makes the case for digital projection.
Okay.
I thought it looked good. I mean, had you not known what it was shot on, you never would have assumed that it wasn't film. I didn't think.
I did pick it as a red production visually, especially in the London sequences, and I think I did that just because I know the footage so darn well. What was the projection like for you, Mark?
I saw it in 3D, so, you know, under over a stop. But I was paying a lot of attention to the low light scenes later in the film, expecting them maybe to be noisier based on the experience I'd had with low light red shooting, and I didn't see any of that. The London scenes that you're referring to, by contrast, actually had a lot more need for dynamic range in them. Is that what you're talking about when you say what you picked?
Yeah. Because this was shot with the Red 1, not shot with the Epic, for those of you that are into Reds. So this is the original Red 1 camera, though modified to have the same chip that theoretically is in the Epic. Now, I say the same chip theoretically, it actually is practically the same chip, but there's different electronics. So the look out of the Epic is slightly different than the look out of the Red 1, because all the backplane stuff is different and all the processing is different. But this is a stereoscopic Red 1 film. By contrast, when Spider-Man comes out, that would be a stereoscopic Epic Red film. And by contrast, again, when you go to The Hobbit, you'll have stereoscopic Epic, presumably shot at about 48 frames a second. So there's a kind of a really good pattern here, which is why I was keen to get this film into our mix, because I'm intending, as you can imagine, we're all intending to discuss those other two films. We're going to discuss Spider, and we're going to discuss Hobbit when it comes out, both parts one and two. And so it'll be interesting to see whether we notice anything different technologically between those three as they progress. I certainly saw it digitally projected, very pristine presentation in stereo. Thought it looked really good, really immersive. And I've got to say, as a film now, if we just change gears for a second and just discuss the film side of it, I thought it was the most piratey pirate film of the four, vastly better than the third, which was basically Out to Lunch on Scooby Snacks, but probably not from a visual effects point of view as good as we saw in maybe two. Not that visual effects were bad in three, but it was just completely plot-wise, just, you know, sniffing the super glue for me on three. But what did you think, Jason, just on the film alone?
As a film, I'm not that invested in the quadrilogy, or whatever you would call it, four films. I never saw the first or the third. I've only seen now the second and the fourth. So, I mean, the second one I enjoyed, sort of. I really liked the Davy Jones stuff. So this movie, it was passable, I guess. It wasn't that exciting, honestly, for me. I love pirates and pirate stuff, but it just seemed like everyone was just like, oh, this, you know, there, it felt like the third or fourth season of a sitcom where everyone knows exactly what their character, who their characters are, what they do and how they do it. And they just sort of just doing it.
I mean,
it's like, this is where the character makes this kind of joke, you know, and,
it could be argued that it could be argued that Pirates has gone down the Happy Days route. And then in fact, Fonzie has taken over the Black Pearl.
Yeah.
I didn't see any sharks in this movie.
Yeah, no, they jumped the mermaid.
Okay.
My only other argument, and this is a spoiler because I know some people have mentioned this in the past, so I'm going to say spoiler alert.
Okay, well, the whole thing from here on is a spoiler.
It's about the Fountain of Youth, and really, it was almost a mimic of the third Indiana Jones movie. Like, we got to find the Fountain of Youth, and we're going to, you know, the good guys and the bad guys, whoever they actually are, even though you don't really know, are chasing each other down to find the Fountain of Youth. One guy finds it, he piggybacks on the other guy, and the hero uses the quote-unquote Holy Grail or Fountain of Youth to save the person that he loves.
Well, now, until you said that, I hadn't seen the indie parallels, but actually they're pretty deep, aren't they? Because that whole initial London sequence had a very Indiana Jones feel to it.
Yeah, and then really, they made, I mean, obviously Indiana Jones made a much bigger deal out of the Holy Grail, but in this movie, in the Pirates movie, I mean, they're at the Fountain of Youth, and no one's diving in and being like, I'm going to drink it, I'm going to live forever. Not one person acknowledges that they're at the Fountain of Youth, really, from a, like, over-the-top, you know, like, at least one dude's going to take advantage of diving into the waters. You know what I mean? I don't know. It just seemed kind of like a throwaway.
But Jason, it had Keith Richards in it. doesn't that bite anything? And it had Keith Richards actually doing something than looking like a galah sitting with a mandolin, which is what he did in the bloody third one, I think it was, where he admittedly just fallen out of a coconut tree, which was just awesomely rock starish of him in the first place. But in the other appearance, he just sat there and kind of basically strummed a ukulele, and it looked kind of lame. In this one, it was great. He killed people and gave advice and came up with really funny one-liners. Like, does this face look like I've been at the Fountain of Youth? And as a diehard Rolling Stones fan, I just found that awesome. I want the whole film to be... I wanted Keith to come back. Okay, Mark, what did you think? Do you think that it is, in fact, Happy Days meets Indiana Jones?
You know, the first script, the first Pirates film, the script is really well written. Like, it's a masterpiece of popcorn movie filmmaking, and those writers are really strong. But in this case, I had really low expectations, you know, and they were met and actually exceeded. I mean, I was really entertained, but the story really, I had forgotten the first act by the time we were in the third. Like, it felt as if it was all there to set up the next action sequence, which, you know, it did a pretty good job of doing. And they set up some pretty good sequences. So, for the purposes of this show, it was a good script.
Okay, so for a film that's fourth in its line, it didn't try a reboot. It didn't try to reimagine itself. It just made a Pirates film. And I think, to be honest, if this was the last Pirates film, I could live with it. If I was to use your Jason indie thing, this was way better as a fourth film than the fourth indie film, and I think you'd have to agree with me.
Absolutely,
It was better than most fourth films.
I mean, Johnny Depp didn't jump the mermaid. You don't feel like, oh my God, why did he do this? This is an embarrassment. And I was, you know, at no point did he go onto the Black Pearl, climb into a refrigerator, and avoid an atomic bomb. So, you know.
Oh, you weren't paying attention, Mike.
Okay, I'm sorry. Now, let's discuss the visual effects. We didn't have, I think, either the budget nor the script that warranted the kind of innovative, Oscar-winning, oh my God, that's incredible, leap in visual effects that we saw in some of the earlier Pirates films. Now, I think from a technical point of view, as much as I didn't like the third one for being, you know, completely on drugs, the fluid sims was spectacular. The facial animation and some of the stuff to do with the tentacles and the way that they interacted and the stickiness of them and the single camera motion capture technology, like in so many of the Pirates films, I've literally just been, okay, well, that just changed the game for this part of the industry, you know. And I think that ILM development of the single camera motion capture was absolutely to this day just, you know, it took me a long time to just sort of fully, actually had to stand there with someone at ILM and say, come on, really? Just one camera? Like, what's the only camera we can rely on? So, yeah. So I don't think it had that. But I will say this. I think that the work of now a variety of facilities on this film, if you were to not sort of put it in the race of the other films from a technology point of view and just let it stand on its own two feet, that some of the other companies or some of the companies involved in this did some really, really solid work. And so I'd like to walk through it. I want to start at the beginning and I want to start with London and CineSite, because how much were you aware when you were watching this, Mark, of the digital nature of the streets that they were flying through?
Oh my gosh. No, it was really seamless work. And when I read later on about the extent to which they were fabricating it, I was pretty amazed. Especially since a lot of the normal tells of that kind of work really weren't there. They didn't make it super grungy and dark and shabby and all art directory. Like, you know, that great set work in Sweeney Todd, you know, right. Would have on a Tim Burton film. But, you know, on the other hand, it didn't have the pristine, hey, we LiDAR scanned this and then mapped it kind of look either.
They did in fact do a LiDAR scan, but yeah, they didn't have that look. I'll give you that. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they did their own version of a LiDAR scan, right? Don't they have all their own proprietary stuff? I mean, obviously CineSite is pretty far ahead with this stuff. Not that other shops aren't potentially at that level, but they seem
I would have thought if I was a punter supervisor and I was going for digital buildings, I would CineSite or DNEG would be the two go-to places I would say for that kind of work. Just for those that don't know, because I think it was so seamless, they did put up a whole bunch of blue screens on location. They were shooting on location. It wasn't like in a studio. It wasn't all in front of a blue screen, but they did stick up several 250-foot blue screens. And then they populated digital people, digital sets, digital set extensions. Of course, there were some buildings to work on. For, I believe, a total of about 19 different street environments, sequences that built from what was at Greenwich where they were filming out using CineSite's proprietary stuff. Now, this is a pretty remarkable exercise because it was a, you know, chase, so the camera tracking is not, you know, without issue. But also, it wasn't just some building extensions. There were like crowds and people and a whole bunch of stuff. And honestly, going through it, knowing, you know, that London does have some districts that are heritage preserved, I just assumed that a lot of it what I was seeing was in camera, and it really, you know, didn't click with me what they'd done. Now, Jason, I'm going to ask you a question here because there's a really interesting problem that came up from Ian Fales here in our office, who spoke to the guys at CineSite when they were doing this, which is that if you're doing this today, you know what the aging on the building should look like. They were doing this. The film is set it actually states when it was set, wasn't it? I think it's actually in the film as like that date is actually
1750.
Yeah, I think it's specifically 1750. Okay, but the buildings are brand new at that point. So the guys at CineSite were faced with the problem that to make these buildings historically accurate, they would make them pretty much pristine and brand new and shiny and sparkly, notwithstanding the kind of dirt that you'd get, you know, from the horses around the bottom. But 1750, these things were built in, you know, in that period, so they would be not very old, hence not very weathered. But for our audience that's so used to seeing those historical buildings in today's setting, which has the carbon from motor vehicles sort of aging everything so dramatically, they would have looked super fake. And in some of the buildings that they put in that were digitally are still being constructed. They're that kind of new. Do you think that, I mean, they erred on the side of actually aging them more than they should have been aged, because otherwise the audience's eye would have kind of gone to them. Do you think that was the right decision?
Yeah, I mean, you can't. I feel like you have a small amount of poetic license to a certain extent, because, I mean, nobody was alive then. So no one could tell you that's not what it looked like. So I think mixing, using a mixture of current
perceptions,
aging and erosion a little bit with what people would expect to see with how it actually would look, I think it's totally, I mean, it's valid. They nailed it. I mean, I had no idea the extent to which the effects were used in a lot of these scenes. And I mean, when I said I didn't like the movie, that was more of a story angle. I mean, the effects were all, I don't think there really was many effects that I didn't like. You know, all the work was really well done.
So for Mark, for you, the building sequences, the way that they were lit and the interaction, because obviously there were lots of things, like there's one point, for example, that they conveniently and somewhat, I guess, I joked on to a friend that there was, you know, that there are a lot of kind of set up pieces in this, but you forgive them. And the coal was the one for me, the coal catching a light kind of running through the street scene was obviously a kind of a very set up, the two carriages and he's spanning them with one foot. It's all very kind of slapsticky, but it's a pirate movie and we kind of expect that kind of stuff. But that being said, that the environments had to cope with those range of smokes and flames and things being all composited in, the windows reacting and the reflections and everything else. Did it all sell for you?
Yeah, I think we're at the point where, I mean, I would think the guys and girls working on this would kind of be licking their chops to get that stuff in there. And I have to say, I mean, I love nerding out and getting stuff accurate in a way that is not pedantic, but is actually has some spirited reason for being that way. It's the David Fincher school of, you know, in Zodiac, they could have shot the entire sequence in a neighborhood that I know well up in Laurel Heights. It doesn't even look that different than it is today. It wouldn't have looked that different in the 60s, but they actually redid the whole thing from scratch so that the trees would be younger, which I just love. So I think going to that painstaking detail is really rewarding overall because, honestly, the flip side is movies that are kind of lazy about it and they're not as visually interesting, you know? And I mean, now that we have the ability to do it and the artists who love to put that kind of care into the shot, I think it reflects well and isn't just an exercise in sort of, you know, going too far and... I don't know. I don't know what the argument would be really against it, but
while we're still on CineSite, they also did Barbosa's peg leg. You know, the amputation replaced with wooden leg stuff. I've got to say, I thought that stuff visually was superb, but there were a couple of shots, unlike the London sequence, where what obviously had been shot and provided to CineSite was a plate that said, "Hey, look at this. We're going to show he only has one leg." Now, the first one of those is obviously in the great sort of escape gag sequence in with the king. And, you know, I loved that. It was all very sort of, I don't know, Errol Flynn-ish kind of stuff. But he, you know, throws his leg up on the table. It's obvious we're going to say, "Hey, look, I've got a fake leg." But that's okay, because at that point it was plot motivated. Later on, there's a bit in the on the boat where he's having, with the worst fingernails in history, a cup of tea and... I think some cucumber sandwiches or something. Anyway, he's throwing his leg around there, and it really looked like it was framed to say, "Hey, look, you know, this actor doesn't have a fake leg, but we're going to digitally chop off Jeffrey Rush's leg, and aren't we clever?" And I don't think that the work was bad. I just think that the need to sort of do that is odd because it takes me out of the film, right? It's like I benefited from them not showing off London with a crazy flying shot that couldn't be done just to show off that they had a digital environment of London. So I didn't feel the need for the DOP or the director to kind of give me a, "Hey, let's check out his leg." Did anyone else, do you know the shot I'm talking about when he's on the ship?
Yeah, I sort of mentally cataloged those as some Captain Dan moments.
Right, right.
Little Forrest Gump style.
No, we're nothing if not obtuse popular culture references on this show.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, the work is fine. It always comes back to story and motivation and why you need that effect or just the scene in general. And that's, I think that's what sort of was my initial comment on the film, that the gags were just gags. And I mean, this is the largest budget, much less largest visual effects movie that Rob Marshall's done. And, you know, maybe either he was having a bit of a play with the resources at his disposal, or I don't know. But I mean, I agree with you that there were some egregious moments that you were just like, all right, I know he has one leg. I know it's Jeffrey Rush. Let's move on.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, it was a good wooden leg, but it wasn't, yeah, it was nothing more. I mean, we kind of, you've nailed it. We kind of seen that in Forrest Gump. There isn't a lot of oh wowness about it for a normal audience even. I think if you were, look, there's a film, a surfing film that came out recently. If you guys remember it, it has a girl in it who had an arm amputated by a shark, and she continued to surf. And in this film, there is a completely different kind of perspective, because in this point, it's a real story. And so, you know, without being gory, you're kind of looking for the missing arm because, and again, I really mean this in like a kind of a non-sensationalist way, but as an audience member, you know that that's a pivotal point, that the whole reason this bloody film was made is because this incredibly resilient girl decided to get back on the board and continue surfing. So there, you know, having a shot there where you're kind of establishing her, you know, without the arm and being a bit more, what did you call it? The Captain whatever from...
Captain Dan.
Captain Dan, thank you. I don't have a problem with that there in that environment. It's so related to the story that you can't be funny. There's no reason for him to have a peg leg in this. It was just, hey, let's just do it because we can.
It's the same as 127 Hours. I mean, there's a reason why James Franco at the end will have one arm. I mean, it's just...
And we're going to look.
You want to see them. You know James Franco has two arms, so you want to see how well they pull it off from a story perspective.
Yeah. So, I'm not buying it in terms of... but by the same token, can I fault the work? Well, not really. Now, I think those guys did about a 250 shot count on the film overall, and that actually included digital toads and a bunch of other stuff that... you know, went into the sequence. So it wasn't just stuff that was done, but that was, you know, one of the big contributors to the film. Actually, Soul Surfer. Sorry, I've been bugging my head. Soul Surfer was the name of that. I think Engine Room did it, right? Yeah. Okay, so that was the surfer film. So, okay, so let's go now to the boats, obviously to the Sailing on Stranger Tides itself. We leave London and we head out, and of course, There are two really big kind of effect sequences, the end of the film, but then this sequence which is going to happen with the mermaids. But to get to the mermaids, we have now and at other places quite a lot of sailing shots and stuff to do with the boats, not least of which is when the rigging comes to life and sort of grabs everybody on Blackbeard's ship. And this was all handled, I believe, pretty much by MPC. I did another sort of 300 kind of shots on that. We've seen quite a lot of these shots of the boat at sea, and on the whole, I think they're really good. But I did think there was a shot of the Queensland's Revenge where I was kind of conscious that the wake profile didn't seem to match the digital boat. And I think it was because they literally just stuck a digital Queen Anne or Queen Anne's Revenge over the top of an actual ocean-going ship, where I had imagined... because I don't know if this to be true, that a lot of the other stuff was digital water, digital wake, etc. Now, does anyone know what was going on there with the boat? Did anyone see anything, or what did you think of the ships and, of course, the digital sails?
It was my understanding that a lot of this was actually practical, and that maybe there were only one or two shots that had a fully digital boat, and actually a lot more of the work was in rebuilding what they had into what they wanted. So, like, they were going around. I mean, one thing about the wakes is I think they were using a motorized boat, and they had a problem where that'll actually make the sails blow the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So they had to basically replace on a moving ship, on moving water, from a moving camera perspective, they had to replace all that. But I didn't pick the shot you're talking about. I do know for a fact Blackbeard's big appearance, which I think, you know, unlike the peg leg sequence, is well served by that fantastic action sequence of the, you know, him getting angry and having the whole boat basically start flinging people around and hanging them and so on was maybe like 70-80% stunt work. And that, and it's similar. I mean, I worked on Pirates 3, and that's, we were doing a lot more of that kind of stuff where we got plates that just needed a lot of work to get them to look like, you know, they weren't stunt slash, you know, rig effect kind of shots. So, I mean, not that there wasn't a lot of digital work, because I know they were also animating ropes, but I think the actors themselves weren't digital doubles. I think they had actual guys getting thrown around in there for the most part.
And I think that helped as well, because there were, I think there's one shot in particular where he goes to jump off the ship and he kind of seems to be grabbed in the air and then hauled back. Now, I don't know if it was that shot, but that if that was a real actor, because I don't know the breakdown of that shot, but it felt very real, and it felt like they were benefiting from the fact that you could put people on wires, because if you're meant to be constrained by a rope and that's constrained by a wire and you put the digital rope on top of where the wire was, you're going to have all the right physics. I mean, it's kind of like what you want, right? Like you're hanging someone upside down.
For once.
Yeah, it's what you want. So I thought that people jumping around and being dragged and hauled up was inherently a good way to go. I mean, it's a good thing if you can design visual effect shots that work that way, right? Because why try and fight, you know, introduce anti-gravity when no one's expecting it? Because it's going to be a hard sell. This is one of those cases where the effects are in sync with how it was pulled off, and so it just ends up with a really nice, believable sequence. Did you, Jason, have any issues with the boat at all, or was it just me?
I think my print probably would have precluded me from getting certain fine detail comparisons. I agree with you. The ropes, they're CG, but I think they were done well, like you said, and like Mark said, for once the artist got to mimic an actual physical event that was captured instead of taking a plate that looked like one thing and having to make it look like something completely different. Did anyone notice that Ian McShane, as Blackbeard, when he came out on the boat, on the deck after the mutiny, was his beard on fire? I could have sworn I saw smoke coming from his beard.
Okay.
Like,
was a bad print, wasn't it?
No, but it looked like they were like smoldering or something. Like there were two like braids or something coming off his beard that was on fire. At least that's what I saw that. And I remember specifically making a mental note, like because then it sort of dies down throughout the scene. And I remember thinking, like, that's really weird. Why is his beard on fire? Obviously not flames, but you could see smoke trails. I don't know what they were trying to intimate, if that is indeed the case, or I'm just on crack. But
the actor that's playing Blackbeard has been criticized around the net as just not being very believable. It just wasn't, they say, his best performance. The actor is a fine actor, but it just felt like he wasn't really comfortable in the role.
Yeah, I mean, it's Ian McShane. I love Ian McShane, Ian McShane can easily fall into like a, what you would currently call like a Pacino, De Niro, Nicholson, where they just play themselves. Like Ian McShane, just his speaking voice and the way he looks is already 80% of what you would want from an actor anyway. That if he just read your dialogue, or if he just read the phone book, you'd be like, wow, that sounds really cool. He was probably not putting his all. It wasn't his Sexy Beast performance. You know, it wasn't his Deadwood performance. But given the tone of the film and the rest, at least how I felt about it, I think he fit in fine. Seemed like he was like, sure, I'll make a movie in Hawaii. Why not?
Okay. Well, let's get to the mermaids. Big kind of set piece, I guess. The mermaids were done primarily by ILM. Ben Snow, I had a chance to talk to Ben. There's a podcast of me talking to him on FX Guide. do you guys want to offer up, Mark, what you thought of the mermaids? Because obviously they had to be both attractive and life-threatening. So, you know, they needed to be both appealing, although they would mesmerize and scare the bajillicans out of you. Otherwise, it's not a very interesting movie to be attacked by a bunch of semi-naked women. That's I think that's a Monty Python sketch. What do you think?
Well, I'd say although the money shot of the film comes later, this is the sequence that makes this movie worth watching for even the listener out there who's like, I hate pirates. I don't like these movies. I'm tired of popcorn movies. I've had it. I want to see art films. I'd see this movie, or at least this section of the movie, for the mermaids.
Yeah. It's a not inconsiderably difficult job merging digital halves to real actress tops. I mean, in fact, this is something we probably will discuss if we do a VFX show on Green Lantern, where they obviously did entire bodies up to the neck merging. But getting that blend between a digital bottom and a top actress half, not really an easy thing to do, because it's an incredibly nuanced tracking and body weight transfer kind of problem. It's not, I guess, as easy as you'd think, because it's not just a matter of the merge line not seeing there, but they have to feel like they have the same physics. Did it work for you, Jason?
Yeah, I actually did like the mermaid section. It had a bit of a, and I'm making another Indiana Jones reference, but it had a bit of the end of the first Indiana Jones movie when the beautiful ghost comes by and turns into the skeleton, you know, scary witchy face. It sort of had that, where you saw these mermaids and then they turned into these vicious, you know, creatures. And at no point did I have that sort of, like you said, the merge line sort of jumpy physics where it was clear that it was CG and they were just sort of like doing a XY sort of push of a character over instead of actual physics. It felt really solid.
Yeah, the environment was kind of interesting as well. Like there's sort of a dark, watery sort of setup. So there's a lot of integration with water, but there's also the flames. And there's that rather, God, I really feel bad for the fact they keep on destroying these wonderful, useful things, lighthouse destruction sequence, which plot-wise I might have had some issues with, how it suddenly solved all problems. But I'd have to say, like, I thought it all played really well, from the integration of digital water to the integration of digital fire to just the body double for the jump down and stuff. It seemed to hang together incredibly well. Now, I don't suppose I'd really expect anything else, but I think it was something that could have come unstuck pretty quick and just didn't. I mean, I think it flowed pretty well. Now, there's something about the grade that made me feel it was all a bit, you know, I think probably that I could see out to the boat so clearly, because obviously we need to see the boat for the mermaids attacking the boat. Or is that the next morning that they attack the ship?
I'm thinking lifeboat for that first sequence.
But there is, yeah, because the boat being attacked happens the next day, doesn't it, when the English arrive and they have no way of going back because their boat is sunk down. But I think at night I still felt like I was seeing far off into the night more than I should, because I think they just wanted the audience to be able to see what was going on. Now, would it play in a serious drama? Probably not. But in this film, again, it's kind of lighter weight, and so it probably played all right. But yeah, I definitely remember thinking at the time that the grade was slightly weird for me. Now, there is a bit of a trend in grading circles when you've got these sort of films to put quite a lot of grads and stuff in. The trouble is, if those grads are reading as shading things, then it can kind of be confusing with the visual effects lighting structures. And I can imagine it'd be quite frustrating if you're a visual effects artist and you've got this gorgeous kind of water reflection thing happening and someone comes along and sticks a bunch of big grads over the top of it for secondaries. But no, I think that would be my only criticism, is some of the stuff to do with the grade and the black levels, not in terms of the composite, but in terms of the final look of the piece. Anything else on the mermaids?
Yeah, I have to give a shout out to Rob Marshall on this sequence, because it's really well set up and established from a filmmaking point of view in terms of setting up a little bit of mystery. And you get to the point where in a film from an earlier era than the one we live in now, you'd see the girl in the water and you'd think, oh, that's all we're gonna see. And then there's this shot where the camera is at water level with her, and then it just tilts down, so we get a peek at the rest of her body, and that's the reveal. And then a lot of the rest of the reveal is done in silhouette. I remember there's a lot of overhead light. Do you remember this? And it's just, those shots looked fantastic, but they also were just a really nice dramatic reveal of like getting little glimpses and not pulling punches. Like, you know, never, I didn't feel like, oh, we're in the dark, they're not going to really, we're not going to really get a full look at this. So, I mean, I guess the flip side of it being magically exposed was that they really, you know, I didn't get the feeling like, oh, well, but they'd never try this in daylight. Yeah.
I thought the underwater sequences of the mermaids, especially when they solved the problem of them killing, like they went down and there was that sort of water blood cloud, you know, when she shoots down with one of the guys, and I thought that was exceptionally well done. I mean, it was really nicely lit underwater. Obviously, it wasn't. It was digitally placed there, but it just, I thought it was just superb. My criticisms before about the lighting were really to do the wide shots above. I think, yeah. Okay, well, let's keep moving. So the story keeps going. Obviously, they've got some other sequences, not least of which is Jack Sparrow doing his jump off the cliff, the 250-foot kind of body double jump down. Interestingly, so the heroine of the film, the female lead, is Penelope Cruz, and Cruz was actually pregnant, and so apparently her sister body doubled for her in the wide shots. I didn't know this until I was doing research that we got through for the show today. Did you guys know that? Most of the shots of her in close up were, of course, her, but then when she went to any distance, because she was pregnant, and you could see the quite large, you know, bump from her pregnancy, her sister body doubled for her. And they tried to match everything up, you know, obviously in wardrobe and stuff. And not a visual effects thing, but it's kind of, in this day and age, obviously you wouldn't want to discriminate against someone for being pregnant, but you would just be like, wouldn't you be kind of like, geez, really? Of all, you have to shoot this now?
Yeah. It'd be like on Apocalypse Now when Marlon Brando showed up weighing 300 pounds.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think in Penelope Cruz, I mean, I like Penelope Cruz.
It's easier
Cruz.
To add it than take it away.
Yeah, that's true. But do you think that, I mean, I think Penelope Cruz is great, and I think that she, you know, was a good female, strong character, and she's a fun actress and stuff. But, I mean, I just would have also thought, well, cripes, you know, can we not do this some other way than have to do it with a very, very pregnant actress? But anyway, let's discuss the end sequence. Now, we're in a...
What about the waterfall, though? Because that was... I mean, I thought that was kind of interesting from the point of view of they thought they got it on set, apparently, and then they realized they needed a waterfall to be like 10 times higher, and it ended up being an almost completely digital shot. And it didn't look like it at all.
This
was MPC?
MPC, right. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, as I understand it, and I've been in these scenarios, so I can imagine how it went... It's kind of like, okay, well, we have a starting and ending shot of the waterfall, and so we'll do CG for the in-between part. And then it's like, well, you know, and they start, I mean, I think what happened is they started mapping it, and basically by the time they had finished with the shot, it was almost all synthesized. But I guess it was so closely based on starting out with real shots that, I don't know, I just didn't pick that at all. I mean, I thought they had a stuntman go off a 250-foot waterfall. I thought it was a great shot.
I thought it was great. I don't think I sort of intellectually thought it was Johnny Depp, but I don't think I thought I was looking at a fully digital shot either.
I didn't need it to be Johnny Depp.
Absolutely. I'm with you. But I guess in this day and age, if I've got somebody moving through frame quickly like that, a body double does come to mind as a digital body double, as a good way to go. But I think the point you raised there actually is a really important one, which is it probably worked so well because they had this terrific reference, right lighting, right setup. of a guy jumping off into, you know, maybe it's only a whatever it was. I don't know. How high was the original waterfall that he jumped? Presumably not.
Well, apparently it was 30 feet high. 30 feet high.
30 feet? Okay, well, that's not very far. Not very dramatic. Yeah, whoops. Yeah. Well, let's all just jump down then. But the point is still, right, the body motion of the guy jumping off, the way he would descend and the way he would go into the water, I mean, that's what you want, right? You want really good reference. So let's hope that that's why, you know, the stuntman did, because obviously it'd be nice if the stuntman's work wasn't in vain. But by the same token, you dream for that from a visual effects point of view, don't you, to just get really, really good reference with the right lighting and the right setup. And not only that, I guess, but the way the director would film it, the kind of framing on the shot, because it's like uber advanced previs to actually get a shot that is what they want, but not big enough, or, you know, you can then take that as your starting place.
Indeed.
Okay, so I want to get on to the end sequence with the Fountain of Youth, even though, of course, Jason's upset that no one was rushing and gushing to drink the darn water. There was some decent fluid sims in that sequence, and I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying Scanline came in as a specialist facility to do that. Obviously, you know, final part of the water sequence with the pseudo kind of what you'd call it water pod, water hurricane thingy that was the destruction of Blackbeard. But it still felt like a set piece to me. What did you guys think, Jason?
It was kind of weird that the Spanish showed up like out of nowhere, as it's back to a story thing, but it was okay. It worked. I was already in the Indiana Jones mindset at that point, and the Indiana Jones one is such a set piece that I was just like, oh yeah, it's the final set piece.
But I thought it was like on a set. I mean, they had that interesting way of getting into it with the, you know, going up, which I thought, well, this is boding well. And then it was always like, it's almost like, well, we've come through the incredibly complicated, no one's ever going to crack it, mystery, magic way of getting in here. Oh, but there's a door over there and everyone else can just walk in. Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Toy Story 2 when they try to get through the elevator.
Didn't it feel like it was on a set?
It worked okay.
No?
What'd you say?
I just felt like it was on a set. I felt like...
Yeah, that's what I meant.
It just didn't feel like it was... And I'm not criticizing the work so much as just maybe that was just the wrong digital environment. I mean, I sort of thought that could have been a lot more spectacular. There didn't seem any reason why it couldn't. I actually thought the boat sticking out from the side of the cliff, the one that had the Pirates of the Caribbean ride skeleton in the bed, that was a kind of more interesting visual and a more interesting kind of piece.
I'm a huge fan of the movie The Fountain, and that representation of the Fountain of Youth, or you know, the whole pool around the tree and all thing. It feels like this, even though obviously it's a pirate movie, so it's not going to be as slick and sort of esoteric. It still felt a little bit like, oh, look, it's just sort of like a hidden, you know, a secret garden. Wasn't as much of a...
It was a secret garden with a drink bubbler that if you knocked over the drink bubbler, it stopped working. I mean, it just didn't have the majestic...
Did you see the Dixie cups that you could... No.
I liked the death of Blackbeard, though. I thought was nice.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the Sims on it was awesome and really nicely handled it. Though the kind of him reaching out from the thing was a bit... because, you know, you imagine it sort of betrayed it not being water, right? Because obviously you wouldn't be able to... You know how he kind of reached out from the water cyclone?
Well, physics-wise, yeah.
Yeah, it just sort of felt like that made it a particle magic dust around him, not a water. If it was a gushing water thing that he could... You know, it was holding on against grim life to not be pulled apart. And then as he aged, his body parts got ripped apart because obviously it was less, you know, what I'm talking about. Does that make sense? Like, if you were holding off against...
It's the old, you know, last gasp for the monster movie.
But I would have done the last gasp is that he was holding on to some kind of rock and it was tugging against the waters, which were trying to pull him apart. And then as he aged, his parts of his body just kind of snapped off and it would be nice and chunky and, you know, you were left with a finger left on the... And then it's off. And it just felt like we had a kind of a non there was no inertia to the water once you can stand there in the middle of it and just put your hand through it. So I don't hate it. I just didn't think it was, it didn't read water sort of heavily for me. But the fluids
I would counter that a little bit. Yeah. I thought this was actually kind of the money shot, and it's in the grand tradition of the Hollywood supernatural death. And in this case, Raiders of the Lost Ark would have loved to have been able to do something at that level, but not that they didn't do something fantastic.
You don't think they should have put Blackbeard in wax and melted him? Time-lapse?
I don't want to commit any sacrilege, but okay. Obviously it ripped the flesh right off that body, and at that point we're into something beyond water happening. And it's kind of a magical moment anyway, the Harryhausen skeleton reaching out. So I didn't actually critique it from the would physics allow this?
It wasn't so much as
I looked at it like, whoa, okay, they went for a money shot here. And these are hard to do. Like, it was a layered thing. I loved how it went from water to flesh to blood, and I thought the animation on it sold it, because that creature is, struggling mightily in the middle of it.
But don't you think there was like a superb piece of aging flesh buildup from skeleton animation, and there was a separate great piece of fluid sim stuff, but you didn't believe the fluid sim was interacting with the aging flesh stuff? You actually thought those two were connected?
I bought it as a magical shot. I'm lumping it in with the Raiders shot, because I think at that point something supernatural is happening, and so I was looking at it much more from the dynamics and emotional animation point.
Yeah,
of view.
But in Raiders, yeah, there's like, the hand of God kind of wispy stuff coming out, and there are these angels / ghouls that are moving around and, shooting through people with kind of light. And I don't expect the light is going to physically push someone over, but I expect that if you dumped a bathtub of water on me, I would fall over, yet alone like several rivers. No? Okay. Well,
but it's swirling around you really fast, and I guess it would spin you right round, baby, right round. I don't know what would happen to you, actually.
You're really going deep on popular culture references now. You'd have to have been listening to the radio in the 80s to get that one.
We're referring back to the 80s constantly on this show. I don't know. I'm just keeping with the theme.
Yeah. Well, Kasha Goo Goo, never heard him. Or is that Dead or Alive? I can't remember.
Dead and Alive. I'm ashamed to know. I'm saying I like Sims in the way I like contact lighting. I like, if something's on fire, it illuminates other things. If somebody has a flash with a lightsaber or a rod, it lights up on the side of the face of the character nearby. I like if you have a ton of water going around a character, that it, is impossible to stand there and not be knocked over by it. And so it just felt like two completely different visual effects. Like, are we going to have him age? Yeah, but it's the Tree of Life with water. Well, let's have him surround with water and then, but hey. Can we agree to disagree? Because it just didn't work for me.
It wasn't life changing. I'm not saying that,
No? Okay, good.
No, it was actually life ending.
Life affirming?
For him, yes.
I think that, okay. But I think still the environment they were in is the thing that was weakest in that end sequence. Yep. It just
totally not memorable.
Yeah.
You would forget that they were even found the Fountain of Youth. It's like, Jason makes an excellent point about the reaction to it, but also, now that this has come up, I can think of so many settings you could do for it that weren't what they did.
Yeah, I would have expected if
Vegas.
You could have had
Vegas backlit. I don't know.
But if you'd then been, that had been inside of a chasm that plummeted down and opened up on a kind of a, vast, had a lot of depth in the shot, and you could really like see down. It was very dangerous being close to the edge. So when they were fighting it, actually made some sense that somebody was in peril and people would fall, and you could, it was all just felt like it was on a soundstage with some rubber rocks and admittedly some nice, circling stuff, but it felt like it was on a soundstage.
Well, you would assume that at least I would, if I was Rob Marshall, from an art direction standpoint, you would imagine that the Fountain of Youth should have some sort of like magical aquifer source, or, you know, it didn't, it just felt like, oh, all the water in this area is the Fountain of Youth.
There actually, no, not even all the water in this area, just the water coming out of the pop-up water fountain in the middle from the, you know, bad 60s.
Yeah.
Sculpturized.
Like it didn't tell you anything. You should be able to see or want to see, I don't know what's happening over there, but it clearly that must be the area, you know, and then they get there. There's got to be there was no mystery to the scene.
Yeah, some people could have gone caving there and quite happily sat beside the large obelisk and not even known that they were next to the Fountain of Youth.
Yeah.
I want at least a bunch of God rays and, you know, angels and operatic kind of stuff. And
yeah, Vegas, like I said.
Vegas, exactly right. and higher oxygen levels, so we don't know that we're actually in the Fountain of Youth and we can stay there all day. Yeah, which I guess, see, I liked the ending when they were out at the island because that felt real and it had a lot of scope. There were some really nice wide shots of him rowing away from that island. Yeah. And then the walking along the edge of the beach and the kind of It's a Pirate's Life for me, great on-location-y kind of stuff that felt real. And both of those two environments, the island that he rows away from, which was pretty funny, and the you know, the walking down the beach into the sunset, terrific. And they felt real. They felt outside. They felt, you know, grounded and yet fun and nicely lit and, you know, obviously pretty colors from the sunsets and all that kind of stuff. I just didn't feel any of that in the Fountain of Youth. It was almost like I would have preferred the Fountain of Youth down on the beach for a more interesting kind of line. But anyway, I've harped on about it enough. I don't mean to...
I think it's probably... I mean, the film was pretty dark and claustrophobic for a long stretch there. And then at the end, you finally get to breathe a little bit and get out in the sunshine.
I would honestly think that the opening London was, from an art direction and effects realized point of view, a more impressive environment than the end environment that we built to. It just didn't feel like we'd come to a place that was the climax of a multi-million dollar Disney epic franchise worth a gazillion dollar film. But hey.
Well, if they'd had the head of the Statue of Liberty on that beach and the...
Well, now you're talking. Yeah, and the fountain had been the cure. Yeah, no, then you'd have been right.
And by maniacs.
Okay,
I'm waiting for that in the Planet of the Apes movie, by the way. That better be in there.
That better be in there. Okay, so good. So so I think there are some other companies that contributed to the film because it was one of those films that was spread around and a number of companies contributed to it. I believe there was some miniature work, though. I haven't been able to work out. Has anyone found out what was miniatures? Our research flagged that there was stuff done by some miniature companies, but I don't have nothing that I've been able to find on what that might have been. Did anyone?
I couldn't figure it out. I saw a new deal in the list, and
I think Kerner in our research, but yeah. So I don't know if that to be the case, but if the guys were doing miniatures, let me just say right now, superb, because I couldn't pick them.
Yeah.
And obviously, the point of that this show is we're reviewing it from the point of view of people in the industry looking at the material. So, you know, we're not trying to pretend like we made it or that we're going to tell you everything about it. We're just going to tell you what we interpreted from watching it. And so I liked the film, don't get me wrong. I did think it was a good pirate romp. I did think the visual effects were really good. I thought it was much better as a film than the third one, though I have to say, Mark, I think, you know, you guys on the third one and the guys that worked on the second and the first one had a stronger visual palette of visual effects stuff to kind of wow with. But, you know, maybe that's...
Well, also, Gore Verbinski is probably a much more visually compelling director than Rob Marshall.
I mean, this film was meant to have been costing $150 to $250 million. And next week on the show, we're going to be talking about Super 8, which was like a $45 million film. And it had some huge wow factorness. And I just don't feel like you got... you know, five Super 8s out of this one Pirates 4 from a VFX point of view. It just, you know, but hey, I'm sure most of the money that was spent on this film wasn't spent on just VFX. I'm sure there was
Bruckheimer's staff of assistants and Johnny Depp.
I was going to say some quite good salaries in there from certain people. But it's
And shooting stereo isn't cheap either.
Yeah. Mm. We haven't really touched on that, but...
No, we haven't.
Shall we do that? I mean, I think the stereoscopically... it was used to good effect. I don't know that normal drama films really benefit a lot from 3D, but when you've got something that's kind of fun and spectacular and exciting and immersive, then 3D is a good way to go quite often, and certainly this kind of filled that bill. There was a couple of obvious 3D shots, the sword through the door, which I think was even in the trailer, but that was fine. I didn't have any problem with that. Mark, what do you think of the 3D stereoscopic aspects? Because it was shot that way, not converted.
Yeah. For me, the 3D was a low point of this one. I didn't get much out of it being in 3D. It didn't feel very much composed for 3D. I thought the shots were really nicely composed, and I could enjoy them just fine without the dimensionality. And at times, I was slipping off the glasses to just even see how much was there. But really, there were other things, and I mean, I know films will do this, but man, in that hall with, it's the actor who played Monty in With Nail and I, who ended up in the Harry Potter films, Richard Griffiths, you know, and they're in the palace, and he's the one who sends them off on the big adventure to find the fountain. You know, there's a turkey, and it was only half in shot, but it's prominently in foreground. Yeah. So right in my face, I've got half a turkey. And, you know, it's the classic problem, of course, of framing a shot like that. But, man, it really just bugged me.
There was one shot that stereoscopically failed for me. And ironically, it was almost the first shot of the film. It's a shot looking over the water at the fishing boat that will pull up the body that you think is dead from the deep. That isn't. That'll then be taken to the Spanish... and there's the camera's tracking in stereo. And the trouble is that because of the way that it was stereoscopically resolved, it felt like a miniature. And therefore, I studied the guys on the boat, and they looked like they were just digital doubles. But because that was digital doubles, which, you know, normally you can sell, but then miniaturized, they look like, you know, almost wind-up doll miniatures on this little miniature boat. And if a large hand had come in and picked up that little sailing boat from the stormy water, and it had been in, you know, Johnny Depp's bathtub, I'd have bought it. So that one shot really didn't play for me. Anything not work for you, Jason?
I saw it in 2D, but I wish I could have added to my general displeasure of the movie to have seen it in 3D as well. I wish I saw it in 3D only to have seen a cleaner print, honestly.
Yeah, well, obviously we had the benefit of seeing this 2-hour and 17-minute film in a more digitally pristine and immersive environment than what you saw.
I was at a Sundance theater, so they have a full bar in the upstairs balcony where I was.
Oh, see, you went the right way.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah,
honestly, 2 hours and 17 minutes, unnecessarily long. That is just...
Well, it would have been fine if they, you know, they had a bit more Keith Richards.
Yeah, they should have put a Ron Wood scene.
That would have been awesome if Ron had come in with the Spanish at the end.
No, I'm saying me, Ronnie.
Myers doing it.
Yeah, Ron. Yeah, it's wicked. All right. Well, I'm really glad to be, you know, anywhere. thanks so much for being on the show, guys. Hey, Mark, where can people follow you, stalk you?
One of these times I'm going to have something exciting to say besides just follow me as Flowseeker on Twitter, that old handle.
Flowseeker on Twitter. It's a good place to follow you. It is true.
Yeah.
Jason, yourself?
I am Jason Diamond, one word, no spaces, on Twitter, and that's fine.
And of course, I'm Mike Seymour, but normally you'll find me over on FX Guide, where I tend to hang out the most. I want to thank you guys for being on the show in particular. Coming up next week on the show, we're going to be jumping forward to Super 8, as I mentioned, I think, earlier. I'm looking forward to discussing that one. It's the great Spielberg film that J.J. Abrams has made. And thank you guys for being on the show this week, and thank you guys also for listening. Talk to you all next week. And honestly, it's the response we've been getting from you guys and the emails we get and stuff that have just made this show so worthwhile to do. And as I was traveling around the last couple of weeks, especially in America at a lot of the West Coast facilities, the number of artists that came up to me that listened to the show and commented and pulled me up on something we had or hadn't said. So if for nothing else, we would do the show just for the feedback into the industry. So thank you guys so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Mike Semel. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011 FX Guide, LLC.